Hey team, things are going to look a little different coming up. But this is a good thing. Sometimes change is hard, and it's something that we have been working on in the background for a little while now. Honestly, change is good. It's the whole reason Hamish and I started the podcast, and we feel the building industry needs it. Oh, and by the way, I'm Matt, Hamish's co-host who loves to poke the bear. But what's cool is we are now recording from the Pro Climber Australia Studios, who are our major sponsor of our podcast. It's like the perfect combination. We're kind of like Batman and Robin fighting the crime against an outdated, crappy building industry. With a perfect combination of pushing boundaries, sharing our knowledge, and starting real conversation about how we can improve the industry. Of course, I'm Batman, and really, Hamish is a little bit more like Alfred. Anyway, enjoy today's episode, which is coming directly from the Pro Climber Built to Last studio. Welcome to another episode of the Mindful Builder podcast. We're recording today out of the Built to Last studio by Pro Climber, who is our major sponsor. Been kind enough to support us after a year of tracking us and probably 10 years of working with their products, Haim. Is that right?
Yep. And Roger, you would have experience with working with Pro Climber systems too, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're best in the trade, really.
We couldn't have scripted that even better.
No, we didn't even get to write that one down.
That was perfect.
So we're with Roger Borland Architecture.
Borland Architecture.
Yeah, I just pronounced it wrong, sorry. Who are you?
Who am I? Well, it's a bit of a long story. How far back do you want me to go?
Go for it. We've got a good hour.
There's an accent there, so maybe let's...
There is. So I'm originally from the northwest of Ireland, from a place called Donegal, which is pretty much the middle of nowhere in Europe and sort of as far north and west as you can go in Europe. Pretty exposed part of the world. Really strong winds coming off the Atlantic. And I grew up on a farm. And really, that's where it all started for me. You know, very hands-on on a farm. You know, we had one of eight kids, and it was very much... Everybody was hands on deck, making sure that we actually got everything done. And my favorite place on the farm was in the workshop. It was actually taking engines apart, making stuff, angle grinder, welder, putting things together, really trying to explore, the physics of actually putting stuff together and how they worked.
Why don't you become a tradie then?
I really liked the design side of it through school.
Yeah, okay. Like
my favorite topic in school was technical drawing, actually pen and pencil, straight lines. And
yeah.
It was sort of set from the start, right? And it was really the only thing at school I was any good at.
And I love it when you've got a detail and you've got like a window sill and you're like, I could draw it and you can sketch. And like, I actually enjoy that myself. Like it's a very process thinking, all right, what if you do this, do that? Like I totally get the technical side of things.
Yeah, so it kind of led into that. How things are put together into design of how things could be put together.
Yeah.
So it was a leader towards that, if you like. And I was never any good at design, I felt, whenever I was younger. And throughout the whole university phase, I kind of failed at design a lot of the time because I came from too practical a background.
Yeah.
And like I was a tradie on site for a little while. I carried blocks and did roofs and skirtings and all that sort of stuff. So I came from a really practical background and also did a construction course for 2 years before starting university because I didn't have the grades to go straight in. And so it took me a while to develop design. And it was only really when I started working for designers, not university people, that I actually started to get it and see the world in a different way, that this is it's a challenge that you need to solve. There's problems in the real world that you need to actually solve.
Yeah.
And that's what design is. It's a problem solving exercise.
Did you do your architecture training in Ireland?
In England.
In England.
Yeah, the northwest of England.
And what does that look like? Because we've had some architects, Liam from HipFest Hype on before talking through what that looks like in Australia. What does that look like in England? Like what's that kind of the learning modules?
It's pretty much exactly the same as the Australian one. In fact, it's borrowed from the British version.
Right.
So it's a 3-year degree first, so undergrad, and then you do a year out in practice, and then you go back in for your postgrad 2 years in university, and then you have a final year out where you do your professional training within a practice, and you actually do your end exams at the end of that. It's only after those 7 years and 24 months of practical experience that you actually can apply to be an architect.
Do you find that I think it's great to hear that you've had this time on the farm as a kid growing up, tinkering, sort of that hands-on touch feel kind of experience. And then obviously you've done this time on site experience as well. Do you think that's given you a bit of an advantage when it comes to your design work, like a more sort of practical approach to your designs?
At the start I would have said no, but now I would say definitely, yeah. Absolutely. It's my approach to design is very practical. It's actually taking a brief and really breaking that down into the day-to-day. I actually think that my approach is a bit like a method actor. It's a bit like Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, going out on taking a role on. Like they said, Daniel Day-Lewis would stay in that character for potentially months after the role had finished.
He only does a few films a year, exactly. Not a year, like randomly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel I'm a bit like that. Like you get so invested in the actual life of the people that's going to live in the building that you become them and you actually envisage how you move through the house and the practicalities. Are they left-handed, right-handed? What does that mean for the kitchen, the bathroom? All these sort of little moves that make the home fit that particular client.
Never thought of it that way.
Do you know what? I just listening to you then talk through that, I think if anyone's going to listen to anything in this podcast, it should be the last 1 minute of you talking. Like I'm talking builders and trades. And if you've ever questioned anything that's on a set of documentation, just listen to what Roger has just said then, because there is so much time and energy and thought that you put in before you actually start putting pen to paper and what that house looks like and something that we might think looks stupid or doesn't work. Why are we doing it?
Why on the left-hand side, not the right-hand
exactly.
side?
Exactly, yeah. So there's a reason. So that's a great idea.
So we'll just finish this right now.
Yeah, we'll just press, we'll just stop. All right, that's a key
time to go home.
Because you, so, and this might be jumping forward, jumping back sort of thing, that you said like with architecture, you do all your training, but you said you pretty much didn't know until you started learning from someone in a practice. Mm-hmm. Could architecture be a traineeship where you spend 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, you do your schooling on the side, but a lot of the uni is just a waste of time and you just start to learn that way? Would that be a better method?
Look, I think the architectural education process is definitely broken. I think there's issues in there in regard to the disconnect to reality and the fascination with conceptual design. I think we really need to get back to focusing towards the practicality of dealing with people and climate and situations that are right in front of us.
Because people think architect, they think the top 4 or 5 architects, and that's what they think an architect is. They don't realise that, no, the average human should be using one.
Can I challenge that just for 1 second? And maybe I'm sort of jumping on the institution side for a second. I really like the idea that in the first 3 years that you're at university, you just have freedom for design and creativity. And that's, I guess, my very rudimentary understanding of what the first 3 years are, where it's basically design without restriction. Don't think about engineering. Don't think about the what ifs. Don't think about this. Don't think about that. Because I think that gets the creativity juices flowing. I think if you're kind of restricting people to just design in a certain way, do you think that we're just going to get a rinse and repeat product at the end? Because like
what we have right now, isn't it?
Well, I love architecture because it's so different. Like right now, my algorithm on YouTube is the local project. I just love sitting down 7 minutes and just watching these homes. Now, I know that they're not accessible for 99% of the population because they're built in a cove in the middle of New Zealand on Waiheke Island or something, and it's probably $20 million to build. But I love the freedom in that design where they're kind of designing without restriction.
Yeah, but there is restriction at the same time. You've got building codes. You've got this client's brief. You've got the site in front of you.
100%.
All of those things are the thing that's actually driving the design, and that's where it really needs to come from. Yes, there's a massive layer of creativity that has to go over the top of that, but it's really a puzzle-solving exercise within all of those things.
Yep.
So the foundations of design are really critical. And obviously that has to remain within the university courses.
Yeah.
You've got to understand proportion. You've got to understand where the sun's coming from, shading. But
the real basic stuff.
Like real basic stuff.
It's an interesting point about the sun thing, because I have talking to a couple of architects where they've been the son or the daughter of a client that's come in, and they've said, oh, we'll design it for mum and dad. And I'm like, okay, cool. Well, do you have any understanding of passive house? No. Okay, well, do you understand passive solar principles? Oh, no. We didn't learn that at university.
Hmm. Oh, wait. Who's this, an architect?
No, this is – so this is experience I've had where I've sat in front of like a Zoom call and the parent – I'm talking to the parents to potentially build their home.
Oh, okay.
And the kid – son or daughter sitting there, and they're an architecture graduate and they're going to design the home. And my question is, you know, this is the type of things that we build. And it kind of feels like it doesn't get taught at university.
Maybe it does. No, it's a long time since I was at uni. But in my day, sustainability and actually site orientation and things like that were definitely not a huge topic.
Yeah.
And it's fundamentally wrong. Yeah. It's like it should be the starting point of everything. It's the first drawing I do on site now is a site analysis.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, maybe I'm a bit harsh with this comment, but when I see someone say, oh, yeah, we design with passive solar, I'm like, isn't that just doing your job?
Yeah.
Like the properly? Should it's they? It's like when a builder's like, oh, we wrapped a house correctly. So it's like, isn't that just doing your job?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a question on another podcast, which is passive solar or passive house? That you can't actually get one without the other, really.
That's a sustainable builders podcast.
was actually a topic?
No, it's right at the end. It's like one of the questions is, you know, are you passive house or passive solar? And the reality is you can't build a passive house without good passive solar. Good fundamental passive
house is just adding on mechanical ventilation, air tightness, and a few other little bits and bobs, really.
Passive solar design should be the absolute genesis of every single design.
It's the very first drawing you do on site. Yeah.
And so
why does it get forgotten though? Where did it get lost?
I think it hasn't been taught from the start, like we were talking about originally. It's just a missing, massive missing piece.
So you said before, you made a comment before about, you said that the architect's education system is broken. I would also add to that I think the apprenticeship system is broken as well. So we've got these two, like,
don't get me started,
completely broken sort of systems where we're sitting at the end of it trying to like fix it all, you know, at the other end where it should be getting fixed back here. So we don't have the problem up here.
Quite right. It's
bizarre.
It's all.
Oh, we've solved all the problems now, right?
Well. Don't I think architects, the architectural, and obviously because we're in the building industry, the building side, we see the problems with the apprentices. That is so far behind times. That hasn't changed since I was an apprentice 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's mind blowing.
Crazy. I'm interested to understand what's your process when you first go to site with a client, like. What are you looking for? What are you trying to experience? What are the information you're trying to get from that site? What time of day do you go there?
So it all starts before I go to site, typically. Yep. So the first thing I do is I actually extract a brief from the client. And it's a bit of a different brief than what a lot of other designers would do. I never start with how many bedrooms do you want.
Yep.
I start with what do you do when you get up in the morning?
Make a coffee.
I love that.
Because that question alone helps me reflect on the route through the house, where they're going to be, do they want quiet, are they mixed up with all the kids getting lunches ready, is it, you know, that really sets the tone for the house from the start of the day. So I track these questions pretty much the whole way through the day. And then on weekends it's different, holidays can be different.
The future.
You actually start to get a picture of the people's lives. And then you start working out, well, how often do they have guests around the house? Do they need that separate bedroom for guests?
Yeah.
Could it be a multi-purpose space? Does it need to be a completely separate studio? Do they work from home? All these questions inform the design process. And it's far more valuable than how many bedrooms do you want and
I love
bathrooms.
That. There's but been yeah, so many just, great little fucking yeah, sound bites
like,
from
so
this
we,
podcast
in our
already.
House, like the team from Alter Ego, some of the questions they asked me, I was like, why the fuck would you want to know that?
Mm.
And then it's like, it makes you, makes sense. Like
again, it goes back to me being that method actor, right? I've got to get in the head of them. Yeah. So if I can do that, then I can actually design a house that completely reflects them.
Yeah, like we've got a client, he's a pilot. Like his hours are all over the place. So he needs a place that the daytime and nighttime aren't really, they're a thing, but they're a little bit different to what we would do. So he needs a place to shut off at night or in the day if he needs to sleep, sort of thing. And it needs to be dark and it needs to be,
Correct.
So, yeah, you do appreciate when you see good design from a builder's perspective and then you start to understand the client and what they do and you go, oh, that's why it is. And that's why I constantly comment to other builders and even trades. It's like, it's not your house. Like, you might design it differently, but you're not the ones that live in it.
Do you think you should – what's more important? Should you see good design or should you feel good design?
It's got to be both. So I think you feel it – is feeling it is probably where the longevity of it is for a family. Yeah. The seeing it is just good architecture.
Seeing it what you can afford.
Yeah, it's to be timeless is really important for the longevity of any sort of building, right? You've got to have the right bones behind it that's going to make sure that it works over a long period of time for multi-generations. So that scene is obviously important.
Yeah,
that's a good question, Hamish.
Yeah, thanks.
I like that one.
I've just written it down. I'm going to use it again.
That's a great question.
Roger, I love that. Like I love just those really simple and they're really intuitive questions too that just make sense. You'd not for a second as you were going through any of that was I'm like, why would you ask that? And I'm like, oh, that makes all the sense in the world. So we've got this lot of baseline information from the client. You're obviously doing your desktop review of the site and all that kind of stuff. When you're actually on site, like do you camp on site? Do you go there at certain times of the day? Like what are some of the things for you to really intimately understand that building site?
I tend to go with the client initially because more often than not, it's a knockdown rebuild or something like that. And so their experience of having lived on the site is very important.
Yes.
So you ask questions like that tree over there, are there birds in that in the afternoon? Like the sounds there, is that really important? Does the sea breeze, where does the sea breeze come from here? Is there shelter? Is it really rough here at certain times?
Is a neighbor a pain in the ass?
Exactly. Sort of you start asking as much of the background of the site as possible from an environmental point of view. And so, again, that sort of adds another layer on top of the design. And then I often will try and stay behind after I've let the client go just to sit on the site and try and experience it. I can't say I go at a particular time of day. It's just logistics usually.
Yeah, of course.
But, yeah, I would love to stay there for 24 hours if I could. The best experience of this and all was there was a site in Brighton that I was engaged to do, and I was looking to move house at the time, and there was an old house on the site. And I actually agreed with the client to live in the old house for 18 months while it was being designed. And that was a pretty awesome experience because whilst I was designing the house, I was there.
Wow.
And so I could see where the afternoon sun was coming from. I could see those birds and the noise of them and how that.
So you write into your contracts now that you're moving in for six months.
That would be ideal. Yeah. That would be fantastic.
And do you think you got a better result because of that?
Definitely.
And do you think they acknowledge that and felt that?
Yeah, I mean, they're not that long moved in, but clearly the site operates using all those things that I found on site, and they will. I mean, they probably didn't live there before themselves, so they didn't experience it.
Yeah, okay.
So they're kind of getting the advantage.
Is that the passive
of
house you just finished?
Well, it's not passive, a high performance.
Can you give an example of something on that particular design and ultimately built project that you might not have picked up on if you weren't living on site?
Yeah, good question. Pants on today.
Yeah. Well, a key one on that is at the rear of the site, there's a cricket oval.
Yes.
And on Saturday afternoons or Saturday mornings, the kids come and they play cricket there. And it's actually a very joyous sound on a Saturday afternoon. But also the way the site was, the fence was quite high and the old house couldn't quite see it. So we actually elevated the house a little bit more so we could peek over the top of the fence naturally. And so now we get the noise whenever the back doors are open and that view of the oval from that.
Do they like cricket?
It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. It's more to do with just the experience and the environment.
Wow.
So, that was one example of
which is what everyone puts that wanky biophilic term on now, don't they? Like, isn't it just like pretty much what you said, experiencing it?
It's experiencing your surroundings and trying to bring that into the design and make sure that that allows for that to happen.
You touched on before passive house and high performance homes and stuff like that. Has sustainability, caring for the environment, energy efficient homes, and all those buzzwords these days always been important for you?
Yeah, they have always been important. Like I said, growing up on a farm at home, it was very much we grew everything we needed on site. It was very much connection with the land, connection with the environment around you. You know, I grew up on a 300-year-old house with meter-thick stone walls that had double glazing, UPVC double glazing in it since the early 1980s.
Makes me so angry.
And it wasn't a warm house.
Well, I'd imagine it'd be so much more fucking cold if it didn't have
but
that.
But I couldn't imagine building an Australian house that was built 30 years ago and putting it there.
Yeah.
or yesterday.
You'd basically be in a shed in that environment, and I would have been better out in one of the barns.
So I reckon at the time, and maybe I'm just putting words in your mouth, did you appreciate where you were living? Because I've got these, maybe rightly or wrongly, like just these beautiful images in my mind of you growing up on a farm in this beautiful old
picking
house.
Picking daisies,
yeah, like, you know, chasing sheep around and picking potatoes. Do you look back on those times fondly?
I absolutely loved it. It is such a harsh environment, though, that at times whenever you're there, you just want to be anywhere else but there.
And was like, one of these areas just wet the whole time?
It rained constantly.
And I'm imagining, like, those brick fences everywhere. Did you have that too?
No,
I've watched so many Grand Designs episodes.
Pebble Dash.
Is that what it's called?
Pebble
Dash. Yeah, okay. Yeah, they won't go crazy for Pebble Dash. And, you know, slate roofs. It's really sturdy buildings.
Yeah.
But they need to be in that environment, of course.
How far away were you from the Atlantic?
There was a bay in front of our house that's less than a kilometre away.
Oh, so cool, like real close.
Yeah. Jeez. The Atlantic is probably 5 kilometres away.
Yeah, so
did you go swimming in summer?
In summer, yeah.
Not in winter.
Yeah, I did it once in winter. That was enough.
Was there any good surf there?
Very good surf, yeah. Not that I ever, it's one of those weird things, again, it's right on your doorstep and never actually used it. It was too cold most of the time.
Cracking surf there, like some of the big wave surfers go there, but they're in like, they've got like this much of their face shown and gloves and booties and stuff. Wild, like the footage of it's crazy.
Too many sharks.
Wheel sharks out there.
Probably too cold for sharks.
Yeah. Yeah, they get wheel sharks.
So sustainability has always been something that's been really important for you.
It's always been important, but it only really came into my psyche whenever I did an exchange and I'm at the University of Washington in Seattle for 3 months.
Oh, yeah.
And there I picked up a book from somebody called Cradle to Cradle. If you haven't read this, I recommend it massively. It really explained this whole idea of designing to not be thrown away, and not even designing to be recycled, but designing to upcycle, like nature does. And it uses the analogy of a cherry tree. A cherry tree blooms in the summer. It has millions of flowers on it, and it feeds the birds. It feeds all the creatures to it. But it has way more than it needs. It has an abundance of flowers on it. And it does that for a couple of reasons. One is the beauty of it for the environment around it. The second one is it drops them all back into the soil and it fertilizes the soil and makes everything around it grow as well. And so that's what true upcycling is. It actually is doing way more than what it's meant to do itself and to support itself. It's actually supporting whole environment around itself. So I loved this idea from a very early age and that exchange program at uni, because that just set the path to me to say doing architecture isn't a one building exercise. It's a world exercise. We have a much bigger influence on what we're doing here, and we need to do it right, because otherwise we're screwing everything up.
And how amazing is Washington State?
It's an incredible
one of the
place.
Most incredible places that
really?
I've ever been.
I've
yep.
been there.
Yep. Yep. We, it's the first place that Luce and I went to when we did our trip from Whistler through Central America through Washington State, and it was just, it is incredible. Most amazing. I love that idea of the thing, the tree in this case, like nourishing everything around it. Do you kind of take that philosophy in the homes that you design, that that the homes you're putting on a site improves the surrounding, I guess, experience for everybody else?
Yeah. Whenever I think of self-sufficiency now, I actually think of it self-sufficiency beyond the site. It's doing things like green roofs, for instance, that actually encourage biodiversity within a neighbourhood.
Which is probably important in the sites that you work on, because you probably don't have the advantage of having a big backyard. So you're trying to put in this greenery and the biodiversity in places that you normally wouldn't go.
Yeah, and that's a key component of it. The other part of it is things like trying to encourage clients to have a small productive garden, because it teaches the kids where their food comes from. Mm. It teaches them that you can grow in abundance and you can grow more than you need. And then you can put a basket out the front of your house and you're engaging with community.
Yeah.
And they're actually, you're part of more than yourself then as well. Yeah. And it starts conversations. It starts encouraging other people to do that.
You need to come, and look,
too.
And look at our food forest at home, man. You'd absolutely love it.
There you go.
Are you growing a lot?
Like first year, we're totally digressing here, but I love this stuff. We started at this time last year, and we have oranges growing, pears growing, fruiting, watermelons growing,
wow,
berries everywhere, like tomatoes coming out of our wazoo, zucchinis.
Will you be self-sufficient from a vegetable perspective? Just certain things?
Yeah, yeah. And like speaking of this connection, we've said to Darcy, because he's quite the entrepreneurial spirit kind of kid, and I'm like, look, any surplus, we're happy for you to go and sell to the neighbours, knock on the door and sell it. However, it gets split three ways. A third of it goes back in investing into the garden. A third of it goes to charity. A third of it goes to you.
I thought you were going to say you took a third share of the company.
No. Connection. It's a connection. It's a sharing, and it's the abundance. It's surplus and stuff. We are very fortunate we've got the space to do this, so why not share?
Has he gone, Dad, what about the overheads?
What's the next lesson? Business 101 first, Matty. I love that.
So that's the cherry tree. That's what you're creating right there, right?
Yeah.
So why'd you come to Australia?
1 year of adventure. That's why I came here.
Right. Yeah. this seems to be like a booby trap for everyone sitting in
everyone's
chair.
I've done it.
That's appreciated.
It's actually going to be really good for the videos. So you come here to travel.
Interactive videos.
Yeah. I got married a year after finishing uni, and my wife and I sort of said, well, like, we've got some choices now. We can go and get a house in suburbia in Manchester where we're living at the time. Or we could go and have a year of fun before we settle down and work out what we're going to do with our life. And so we looked at various places around the world, and Australia had always appealed to me because one of my good school friends in primary school moved over to Melbourne in the late 80s. And always had an image of Australia in my mind and wanted to explore it because of that. And it was, that was the top of my list, really. So came to Australia, did 6 months in Sydney working for a company over in Neutral Bay designing beach houses, which was just a dream.
Yeah. Yep. Particularly there and the clients and the houses that you're designing.
It's incredible. Yeah. It was just, this is what architecture is about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So it was a wonderful experience, but I always felt like a tourist in Sydney, and I was deliberately a tourist in Sydney. Like, we had thousands of photographs of go out every weekend and just explore and enjoy the environment. And then we had planned to do 4 months in Melbourne, came here, got a job within a couple of weeks of being here, and pretty much immediately got sponsored and stopped taking photographs. And looking back on that, that was just a sign of the comfort of being here.
Yeah.
And knowing that I didn't need photographs to remember those places because I would just go back there anyway.
Yeah. Wow.
And I never, after being here nearly 20 years now, still haven't explored the rest of Australia, which is the
I was going to ask
the
you,
last in month the, that we were actually supposed to do.
In that 12 months, did you just spend it in, well, you've obviously been here for a lot longer now, but 6 months Sydney, 4 months Melbourne, you didn't do any other travel?
Well, that was the plan, but no, we didn't get there.
Have you got there since?
Not as much as I'd like to. Okay. It's still on the to-do list, a lot of it. But
I think this same for me too. Yeah. Like, I've lived here all my life. You know, there's still many places, so many places I want to go and see.
And then just that was it, never went back?
Well, been back obviously for trips, but yeah, never gone back to live. The longer term plan is to go back.
Yeah.
So I'm very much building the businesses to be self-sufficient without me at the moment.
Yeah.
And so that's an ongoing process. So within 4 years, the intent is for me not to be leading these companies at all, so that somebody else is actually, well, a team of people are doing it without me.
Yeah.
With all of my ethos and all of the direction that I have extracted from me and put into a process instead.
Yeah. And so you want to go back to live in the UK?
Yeah, well, there's a big family draw. We've got no extended family here at all.
Yeah, it's difficult.
It's been really difficult, especially for my wife.
Yeah.
So it would be really nice to be closer to them, certainly. And I'll probably end up doing, 6 months in each place. Yeah. So that would kind of be the ideal. But
and how old are your kids?
They're 14 and 8.
Okay. Yeah. So would you wait for them to finish school?
Yeah, well, in a few years' time, we'll get to the end of my daughter's high school and also the end of my son's primary school at exactly the same stage.
Yeah. So it's a good time.
It might be the ideal time to do it, but that's the plan. Yeah. Whether it happens or not, I don't know yet.
Builders, architects, let's be real for a second. We've all seen what happens when a cheap wrap fails. The callbacks, the moisture damage, the headaches. For me, wrapping a house with Proclimate is a non-negotiable of any build we do. It's about building tight, ventilating right. And when you use Proclimate's tapes and membranes, you're giving your client a premium watertight envelope that prevents the building from moisture issues. It's faster to install, tougher on site, and it means you can walk away from a job knowing that the frame is protected for decades. Don't cut corners on your envelope. Visit proclimber.com.au today or head to the Instagram page at proclimber.au.
And you talk businesses because you are, Borland Architecture, and you're also an author.
Yes.
A book, which thank you for sending that across. I'm halfway through it.
And you've just started another business?
Yeah, I've got two other businesses. I've got one called Stillhouse, which is high-performance prefabricated homes.
Right. With
Carbonlite.
Yep.
Carbonlite are doing the full structure of that. So the prototype of that is starting on site next month.
Yep.
Oh, you've got a project that's taken it on.
Yes, absolutely. So that is a very exciting adventure for me because it's really about trying to lower the cost of high-performance buildings. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that, in my mind, is to actually do a pre-design, pre-engineer, pre-certification process, and then prefabricate it so you're removing the labor from site.
Yeah.
And, what we're producing is going to suit a lot of people in regard to the layout and so on. 20 years of my experience putting buildings together, I kind of know what the general briefs are and can design buildings without really thinking too much about it that will suit.
What was roughly the size and what did you get to build cost if you're able to share that?
So the prototype is 208 square metres, double story.
Nice size.
And it's come in just over $1 million, so $1,060,000, $60,000.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
But we need to also understand how that's going together and the speed that it can get built as well, because I've actually seen some of it, the model, when I've gone into Carbonlite before. And it's the speed. Like you're spending a mil or whatever, but it can be done in like 6-8 months. Have you got like a construction timeline for it?
The first one's really a testing process because we're all kind of new to it. And so we're going to be using this as we're going to record every process on it to actually iterate and make it better from here. And so we think this first one will be the slowest.
And there's no customization on it. It's just this is what you get.
Yeah, there's certain things you can customize. So
like a stone benchtop kind of thing.
Yeah, look, the building envelope itself is set. Yeah. And that's where the efficiency comes. As soon as we go in and start tinkering with the design of that, then you might as well design a custom home again.
Yeah.
And have you modeled it to different orientations as well?
Yes. So
got it.
So we have a number of different models that suit different orientations. Mm-hmm. So if one's designed for a northwest orientation, I won't sell it for an east-west site. It just won't happen.
Yeah.
Because it won't actually meet the standard.
Yeah.
But the first one passed the preliminary passive house tests with flying colours.
Yeah.
We know it'll be a very good house to be in.
Yeah. And this is going for full certification?
Yeah, the first one is, yeah.
And is that the goal, to get them certified? And if not, do you kind of have some parameters that you want to work within? Because not every site's going to be your perfect site for homes. Like, would you be willing to sell the design and the homes for something that doesn't quite meet Passive House Classic?
Yeah, absolutely. If, you know, it's still going to be a high performance building, right? Yeah, it's still the top, right?
0.01% of housing.
That's right. What I was getting at, because, you know, sometimes you want to see this at scale, and it won't go to scale if you're going for perfection.
Now, the passive house component of it is an optional extra for any client.
Yeah.
And so if they want that certification, they pay for it on top.
But the baseline is airtight, HRV, thermal bridge-free construction. Yeah.
Where are we able to get the cost efficiencies? Just purely going prefabrication?
Now, we've also then looked at the procurement of all of the materials that come into the fit-out and the cladding and so on. And the best place to find value in that is volume build.
Yeah.
And so we've gone down the route of finding a volume builder and give them a plug, Oak Living. So they're going to be our partner for construction and doing everything outside of the shell of the building.
Yeah.
And so they've got a great network of trades and suppliers and materials that they can bring in at a much lower cost price than you guys can, and typically most of the builders that I can use.
Yeah.
But they're not touching any of the thermal envelope of the building at all.
Yeah.
So they move into the house and it's already passive house.
Yeah,
the carbon buck the frame up, they sign off and do the foundation.
Or using certified installers.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So in this case, Oak are doing the concrete slab, but then we're over insulating it anyway on site. So again, it's a pretty low risk element for them to do. And so that's the idea, is like, what elements of the building can we give to somebody in the volume build space that is low risk to the thermal performance of the
building? They're kind of taking it from lockup to final.
Do you give everyone like a Stanley knife license before they step on site, or?
Yeah, so they've been well briefed on that side of it. And so, again, that'll be a learning exercise for them as well.
I truly hope that this takes off, because I feel like for it to be accessible and achievable for a broader population, I 100% agree with you. You need to get the volume builder guys involved and excited about it and seeing that it actually is the pathway forward. So
the price for that is unreal.
Yep.
Like,
it's a great price. Yep. So what's that?
5,000 a square meter. 5,000
a square, yeah.
We probably wouldn't be able to build that ourselves for that price.
No.
No, that's from the discussions I've had, I reckon it's probably one of the cheapest passive houses in Australia.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Right now, definitely.
Yeah. That's and have you just simplified the internal fit out? That's where you've saved a lot of money too, like the architectural interior design look?
It's a pretty architectural product even at that price.
Really? Okay.
And Carbon Light have a cheaper product themselves as well. They're working with Envirotexture as well. So they've got their own brand going on at the same time.
Yeah.
And theirs is actually a lower price point than ours. But they're not necessarily chasing passive house. They're not quite as high performance as ours.
Yeah.
And they're not as architecturally designed. I'm sure they won't mind me saying that.
Yeah.
But they solve a problem though, because I've seen that design. It's up in Gisborne or something.
Yes.
Yeah. It's still a great home.
Absolutely. Fantastic home.
Yeah. A comfortable, healthy home to live in. And do you know what? It fits the space in the market. So we need these things at every different level.
Correct. Yeah, so this whole thing came from an idea where, you know, I've been working on high-end homes with big budgets for many years, and to me, if anybody wants to build a high-quality home, it has to be high-performance.
Yep.
You know, that's the real missing piece that has always been in high-spec homes. It's like they put their money in the wrong areas.
So I won't talk to the architect I was talking to the other day about this, but a good friend of mine, we were talking about just would I do some of the projects that they've got coming through at the moment, and he goes, oh, would you consider doing it if it's not high-performance? And I said to him, well, don't tell them it's going to be high performance or not. Mm. Don't give them an option, because I'd guarantee that once we're in and once we've had the ability, the opportunity to educate and demonstrate what we're doing, your high performance clients are going to want the high performance building, because it's going to be like, well, duh, of course I want that.
Of course.
Do you tell them it's a slab? We're going to build a concrete slab?
Yeah. I'm just saying, remove the whole narrative around high performance and just say, this is what you're getting. This is our minimum standard.
Correct. That's very much the approach I take. I don't talk about sustainability. I don't talk about high performance as such. I talk about quality.
Yeah.
And it's about trying to say, well, you've got a decent budget. You want a really high quality home. You want your kids to have this home and their kids after them. Then this is the way you're going to do it.
Narrative.
Perfect conversation. Like, constantly I get someone on social media reach out that's a trainee. We really want to use a ProClimber product, but, well, it might be expensive. How do we talk to the client about it? I was like, you don't. You just do it. Like, they don't give two shits. Like, we're talking on a job, a few $100 maybe. Like, just don't talk about it.
Yeah. It's our job to give them what's going to give the best outcome at the end of the day, right?
You don't need to get talked in the nitty-gritties about water management and vapor transfusion and how the tapes are adhesive. Like, they don't care.
Yeah, but there is a balance in the design stage on budget as well, obviously. And so I balance that by saying, well, you don't need that extra ensuite.
Yep.
You know, that's your heat recovery ventilation and your airtightness sorted.
The hydronic heating that was $100,000 will save you 50K by building it airtight and putting a HRV in.
Correct. And that comes back to the briefing. You know, what do you do in the morning question? Because if I can design out that ensuite that they thought they had originally, I mean, I could sketch up a concept that shows them a concept that would have an ensuite for every bedroom and one that actually suits their lives, which is much smaller, and then saying, this one's a much more aligned building, which is high performance. This one's a bigger building that maybe the real estate agents out there will try and sell as being better, but it's going to be uncomfortable to live in. It's going to be hard to clean. It's going to be too big for your lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's going to be just not a comfortable building.
So real estate agents, you've just started a business with a real estate agent.
Yes. So this is again trying to start the design exercise earlier and earlier. And so the thought with the real estate stuff and something I've been doing for years is actually trying to feed real estate agents design concepts whenever sites come on the market and saying, you could sell this better if you had this concept on the land so that the general public could understand what they could actually do on it once they buy it. And so it's about filling the blanks between what's possible and what's imaginary, you know? It's actually trying to put something in front of them that's a bit more real.
So how do you, just a comment before all my family real estate agents, so I can say this, that they'll constantly add this, more. How do you have that conversation with the real estate agent saying, no, I'm the architect, I know what design, like let's not worry about resale value so much, or that conversation?
Oh, look, the resale value is obviously important. And depending on the client's needs, a lot of them are sort of building a forever home.
Yeah.
And
resale value is not important.
Resale value is not necessarily an issue, although things do change.
Yeah.
And so you've always got to think about the resale value, despite the fact that they're designing a multi-generational home for themselves. But what I'm actually doing with real estate now is actually putting together a different narrative about what a quality home is, and marketing that instead of marketing extra en-suites. And so it's about selling the idea of comfort. It's selling the idea of of a clean air inside the house, no mold, and a structure that's going to hold up for a longer period of time and create longevity.
Or by building a smaller home, you then have a backyard that your kids can use, and you've got your producing garden here, and you've got a space where you can have drinks outside. Like, it's these outdoor areas are so much cheaper to build than another bedroom.
Everyone complains that we don't have backyards anymore. It's because we're building fucking gigantic houses.
Yeah, well, you don't have a backyard.
I've got a front yard that's my backyard, and I also live on 190 square metres.
You've also got a tiny size
of my land's this half the size of one of your driveways.
You've done well with your home by actually having a space you can go into and utilise.
Yeah, but we didn't look at resale value. Like, I don't know, I've got pretty strong opinions, and we'll probably digress too much on this. I think we just got to – we need to design and build for the people who live in the house. I couldn't give two shits if my house doesn't suit the way that the next person buys it wants to live. They didn't pay for the build.
But I'd also argue, say with your home, and I'm thinking about your home specifically, it suits you perfectly right now, and it's what you want to live in. And I'd almost guarantee that there is another you or two other yous out there. There might not be 50 people coming through, but there might be two yous that really value what you've built, and that, I think, is going to get a premium.
But this is exactly my point, 100% my point, because you get real estate agents saying, oh, two bedrooms, that's not enough. You need three because the next person wants three. There's people who just want two bedrooms.
Yeah,
there are.
Like, so you save on your build costs, you save on your running costs, and someone who buys it, yeah, you're not going to get as much for it, but you didn't waste all that time and effort expenditure to get there, because someone else is just going to probably most likely inherit the extra bedroom that they're never going to need.
Yeah, one of the questions I often ask clients is, do you want bigger or better?
And they go both.
Yeah, you can't always have both, though. And so, but there's also been domain sustainability reports over the last couple of years has come out that's demonstrated the value of sustainable features within houses and how people are willing to pay well over the odds because that's been included.
Yep.
And Canberra
needs to show the star rating.
100%. Yeah. That should be.
Should be in accord for sure.
Yeah.
The star, I think the star rating, is it that where they're putting in the NatHERS?
Yeah, but I know it's not the best indication, but at least they're doing it. Yeah. You have to show the star rating.
Mine's 9.6 anyway, so I can't complain.
Yeah.
That's sure if we off. Take into account sure our blower door test.
Yeah, sure.
That's
sure.
Like that, but sure. Like, I think that's...
Was it the tightest building in Australia?
No.
There's a big claim at the start of the episode.
Yeah, there was a lot of that in there, wasn't there?
Stupid. Yeah, as soon as I said it, I was like, fuck, you idiot, Matt.
How with a circle window and the architecture of that home, you are never getting the tightest building in Australia.
So we actually, a bit off topic, we actually got the volume of the high, like the... That building that got the tightest, we would have beat it. I just had no volume to work with.
Yeah,
that was my issue. Like, and it was so complex.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I just wouldn't have made the claim.
But good. But I know. Good, like, you know, when you're like your first day filming Grand Designs, all I'm going
to
say.
You always have to have some fear in your Grand Designs.
It also makes for a great conversation now that I can, like, hey, oh, Matt, remember when you said that?
Yeah, yeah.
As soon as I said it, Drew's like, you idiot. But we look.
Cameron, hang on, let's land on. You got
0.25.
Yeah, so it's first, ridiculous.
It's incredible.
But the first time that Drew reckons he's done a blower door test where pressurization and depressurization were the same number.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So like it was like they were both 0.25 and like the do most you, straight little
do you,
graph.
Do you, sorry, we're digressing. Do you put that to the external sheathing?
Yeah, well, we applied and we adhered. And so, 100% worked. And that's probably giving me more confidence. Like, and having a conversation with a client yesterday where we're taking a bit of an unconventional approach to build a passive house with just an external membrane. And
he's
like, will you guarantee 0.6? I was like, selfishly, part of me goes, no, because I don't have my membrane, but I know that every job we get it is fine. It's just the fear factor of-
we're digressing here, but we're going to go down this path anyway. I think my opinion is this. So we have a project that we're starting later on this year and we're having a conversation with a client next week where we're going to be pitching. I've already pitched it with a designer. We're going to pitch to them that go, we're not going to put an internal membrane in. We're going to give you a 90mm frame. We're going to do 80mm OSB, peel and stick, and then wood fiber. So your WRB and your air tightness is in the middle of your wall. Perfect wall.
You've got peel and stick. I've got.
Peel and stick. So I think that it's actually going to be easier to get airtight because you're completely uninterrupted.
Mm.
No external cantilevers or anything. It's all going to be monopoly built, and we're going to put timbers in the wall to then bolt stuff to for all the balconies and stuff like that.
100% easy. That's what we did.
If the client said to me, can you guarantee 0.6? I'm like, absolutely, I can guarantee 0.6. No problem whatsoever.
Yeah, I'd guarantee 0.6, no internal membrane with the Adhero externally.
Yep.
I actually think it's even easier.
Should we be saying this now that ProClimber are...
No, but it's a reality. But the thing is... Because
we're going away from their system. We're still using...
No, it is their system though.
We're still using all their products and stuff like that. But I think it's a really achievable way of doing it. Now, would it work in every climate? Probably not.
I'm pretty sure external membrane, external insulation will work in any climate. I think that's literally the beauty of it.
The
internal ones only for airtightness, right?
And depending on vapor transfer.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying in different climates. So yes, it's pretty protected because the whole assembly is warm. Yeah. So your risk is a lot lower. But in saying that, every project needs to be modelled.
Yeah, and you got a HRV as well to actually remove a lot of that moisture. So
we do, and we're currently sitting, kitchen sits at probably about 60%. I've learned a few things from living in the passive houses, and I'll tell anyone now, get a cooler doona. Like, it's fucking hot in your bedroom at night. Having three people, me, Nicole, and Noah, the little one, like you climb about a degree and a half overnight.
Just
like,
wait till you add another kid to that one, mate. Three kids in the bed.
So you need a lighter doona, and we just had to go get one last night. That was half the reason I picked up another camera because I was going. It was getting too hot.
I saw another line item on that receipt.
The other thing is, so double story. Like, we just run our aircon now on the flow fan speed. It comes on at 8 o'clock. We'll go off at 7 PM at night, and it will turn on at 23 degrees. That's it. That's all. The upstairs, the heat will rise and it takes control. It kind of keeps everything at bay. That's probably the other thing. But cooking in the kitchen, because it's so efficient inside, like, you cooking will heat your house up, and you notice it in the kitchen. Like, you will climb a degree and a half when you just cook.
You're externally exhausted in the kitchen?
No, I'm not. I'm one of those gone against the advice. I've got a downdraft range hood. So we're tracking it. I've got cams. We've got a sensor in there at the moment, censoring the PM.
What's your take on that? I think we're putting them in more and more buildings now, externally extracted.
Yeah, I've changed based on Cam's advice as well recently. Yeah.
So I've gone against Cam's advice, and I'm going to prove him wrong. And I'm cooking so clean so the data doesn't go up.
I mean, you've got anecdotal evidence on a sample size of one. It's probably not a really good representation of what we should be doing in the industry.
You do peak. Like, when I was frying some dumplings the other day, I sent the particulate matter through the roof.
Yeah.
But then I also tracked versus the bushfire, and I had a zero particulate matter out inside, and we're hitting 100 outside from the ash falling. So you take
these buildings work.
Yeah, it's the thing that I've learned is the aircon becomes a dehumidifier. Like, you do need to also run your aircon probably a lot more than I thought. Nicole was like, I thought we'd never have to turn it on, and I'd hate that feeling.
You need your aircon in a passive.
Yeah, house. Like, that latent heat. It is a thing, and you do feel the mugginess sometimes. And I think this summer's actually been quite a muggy summer in Victoria. Like, I found it's been quite humid compared.
Today will be because it's just rain.
Yeah, so we have been able to eliminate that. But yeah, going back to the airtight comment, it was stupid, but you got to have fun, and I don't take myself too seriously with those things. Like, I knew
it was a good episode.
It was a good episode.
It was. Well done.
I had more people messaging me about it, like, oh, my God, we love Noah. I'm like, hey, the house is pretty cool. But no, she's taken mine. But we've had super positive feedback about it. And I encourage anyone actually openly here that to sign up to, if you've got a cool project. Like, I know the advertising for transformations right now, it's not what you think. Like, we see so many TV shows like The Block. And it's all drama, drama, drama. These guys are unreal. Our producer Steve, like, he made us feel so comfortable. If he said, if you ever didn't like something that we're recording, or you didn't feel comfortable recording something, we'll just cut it and delete the audio straight away. So they are there for you. They want you to succeed. Yeah, there's drama along the way, but the owner builders do that themselves. Like, that's their own problem. But yeah, it was a super fun. I loved it. I do it every day again. And I'm going to encourage you to do your barn, Hamish.
Thought across my mind, but I might save it for the house.
Do both. We've gone real off topic.
Where were we? Welcome to Matt and Hamish. We were going so well for a minute there, and then we're just like, we're over here.
I don't know how we ended up on Graham's Eyes.
We're over there.
We were talking about real estate.
Real estate. So the new business that you've got, you're going in and you're encouraging clients, or encouraging the real estate agent to show to the clients what could actually be on that site.
Yes, that's where we're up to.
So are you coming in, like, say, I had a phone call yesterday from a client saying we're thinking of buying this block.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the ideal scenario where...
I'll have to pass on a number then.
Yeah, real estate. Yeah. So the intent is that we get in before that purchasing decision has been made, because more often than not, clients come to me having bought the wrong site.
Mm.
Like they've got this brief that they want to achieve, which is fantastic, but the site's orientated wrongly. There's issues with overlooking. There's issues with overshadowing.
They can't afford what they want to build on that site.
And, you know, there were other options. And so the intent that we have is to provide certainty before they spend that money, which is often the biggest amount of money they'll ever spend in their life.
Yep.
And more often than not, they're making that decision without proper guidance from experts.
Yep.
And I say that including real estate agents, because they're not experts in design.
Yeah.
They can't actually advise people the best sort of building that could be put on a site to actually work out what that value is. And so what I do instead is I'll analyze that site both from a planning and regulatory point of view, also from an environmental point of view, but I'll also take a architectural brief from them at that stage.
Yep.
All those questions that we talked about before. And I'll actually map out a floor plan on that site to see if it actually works.
Yep.
And I'll measure that then and give them an approximate cost of that building. And we'll not go to a builder at that stage. Well, it's just high level, but it's giving them a lot more information than they would have at any other time.
Well, I mean, I'll give you the example of the phone call I had 2 days ago. She's like, we're looking at this project in Brunswick, and I'm like, great property. Yep, I see that you're growing family. You know, you want to keep this section of it. And then she's like, how much is it going to cost? What would you do on the site? And I'm like, well, I'm not a builder. I can only talk
architect,
to...
You are a builder.
Sorry, I'm not a... I am a builder. I'm not a architect or a designer. I can only talk to that there's going to be a certain chunk of money you're going to spend on demolition, and I don't think there's going to be many restrictions on building something on this site. That's all. That's the only info I can give her. And she's like, well, how much will it cost? And I'm like, I don't know.
But the same as real estate agents. People need to remember they're not there to support the buyer. They're there to sell the house for the seller. Yeah. That's their job. They're not. Yeah. People come and, oh, the agent, he screwed me over. He got heaps out of me. It's like, no, that's their job. They're there to get as much for that seller as possible.
Yeah, and we'll work on that side of the deal as well. And so the intent there is if somebody wants to sell a house, what we'll do again is we'll look at the potential of that house. We'll actually pull out the things that are working really well. Is it well orientated? Is there a beautiful tree with a potential view towards it? Is there good cross ventilation? Could you put solar on the house? Could you upgrade the windows now? Would that be worth it? But we also do overlays, like, let's say the house needs a new kitchen. A lot of agents may advise that client to put a new kitchen in. What we'll do instead is actually do a concept of what 10 kitchens could look like.
Yeah.
And we'll put that in front of the market and say, which one do you want?
Yeah. Okay.
Instead of building it, because if you build one, the chances are that somebody in the walk through the house will love the house and hate the kitchen.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't make any sense for them to actually spend that money up front. And so we'll do that, but we'll also do it on a much larger scale where it could be the whole house needs extending and renovating. We'll actually map that out in concepts and portray that in the marketing as well. Could be a knockdown rebuild, so we'll show what could be put on the site as potential. It could be a development project.
And you need to move pretty fast though, because someone could pick it up and it's up for sale in a week.
Yeah, and you know, we're pretty good at doing that. We can analyze these things and actually get a sketch design done in 2 days usually.
Yeah, okay.
But we'll do that across multiple sites for a buyer, and then we'll do it for the individual sellers to help them sell as well.
Yeah.
We've got a segment called the Mindful Moment, sponsored by MEGT, Australia's leading apprenticeship provider. The whole idea of this segment is to give advice or a bit of a tip to someone that's an apprentice or someone that's growing in the industry that they can take forward and learn from. The question, Hamish and I usually do this, but I've got one for you, Roger. Architecture is changing, and how young kids who are studying architecture, it's not what when you studied, it was kind of a very clear path of becoming an architect. I feel for the first time ever that is not as clear, and an architect now is not what it's going to be in the future. What tips would you give to someone who's starting their architecture journey, maybe second, third year out, to give advice on sort of what to plan for or look for in the future?
It's a very interesting question, because obviously with the rise of AI as well, a lot of people are starting to freak out about design work and how that's going to actually look into the future. And I've had a dad reach out to me recently and said their daughter's thinking about doing architecture and asking for advice on it. And so my advice is that design will always be needed. And it comes down to that human touch. Like I was talking about at the very start, that briefing exercise and extracting that and reflecting that back into a design and build project. You're always going to need that human touch to understand that properly. A computer is never going to be able to do it. And
the computer wouldn't have picked up the cricket in the backyard. Exactly. And, you know,
and that the birds are there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in that tree.
People just sit there and type into ChatGPT, design me a 3-bedroom house, 2-bathroom, and they get a full set of working drawings and plans. It ain't happening.
Correct. So, look, I think there's always going to be a place for an architect, but it's going to have to be architects with this sort of mindset of reflecting a client's needs and what the best outcomes for a given site are, and being able to extract all that information and reflecting that back into the design exercise itself. And
my experience with ChatGPT is it's never telling you anything negative about what you're putting in either.
No.
So, you know, you as a human being can challenge someone's wants or needs or ideas, and AI is never going to do that.
And don't get me wrong, I use it all the time for everything I do.
Same.
But I find it an amazing tool, but it's an exercise of refinement, and it's an exercise of actually testing sort of new things that you put in front of it as a designer.
Yeah.
To make sure that it can work.
It's just another tool. Like you have ArchiCAD, it's just another tool that you can use. It doesn't do the job for you.
It's not, definitely not. So there's a bright future in architecture, I think, but only for the people who can actually navigate this moment in time carefully.
Yeah.
Because I think there'll be a lot of people will be without work after this, because they go down the road of just saying, I'm going to stick with what I've been doing previously and that's not going to work. And there's other people that are going to go, I'm going to run full head into AI and that's going to solve my problem. They're out of business as well, I think, because the AI will actually take over and they're going to be out of a job completely.
I think the description you used before of AI as a tool is the perfect description of it. But it's a tool that you need to learn how to use.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So big thank you for MEGT for that segment. Roger, someone to get onto you, best way to get onto you, Instagram, social media, websites?
Yeah, so website borlandarchitecture.com.au. Actually, the tag is www.borlandarch.com.au. And on there you'll find Stillhouse as well, which is the pre-designed series of buildings we've done. Realrealestate.life if you want the real estate stuff. And we're also on Instagram and Facebook. So just look up Borland Architecture and Real Real Estate on there.
Awesome. Thank you
very much for coming on.
Thank you so much, guys. Cheers. Really appreciate it.